It's time for Magnuson Nature News, a monthly program about the amazing nature inside Magnuson Park. Each episode has a different theme, featuring animals or plants that live here in the park. You'll hear fascinating facts and true nature stories, interviews with kids or adults who know a lot about nature, the best places inside Magnuson Park to find animals and plants, and much, much more. Magnuson Nature News is brought to you by Magnuson Children's Garden, a great place for the whole family to visit any month of the year, and where all of our events are free. I'm your host, Emily Bishton, and I'd like to give a special welcome to all kids and adults who know me from my years of teaching at Magnuson Children's Garden, Magnuson Nature Programs, and the Jane Addams Sandpoint and Dunlap School Gardens. Magnuson Children's Garden is delighted to be a part of Space 101.1 FM and hope you enjoy this edition of Magnuson Nature News. On last month's show, our special guest was Chris Anderson from the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife, talking about how wonderful bats are and all the amazing things that he knows about bats. In fact, we had such a great interview that he is back again this month to talk more about bats and how wonderful they are, and give us more interesting bat facts. Chris, it's great to have you on the radio show again. The first question I have is one that I'm really interested in, partly because I grew up in the Midwest, where there are lots of caves and places that bats roost in and hibernate in all winter long. And I think our listeners would be interested in the answer to this question too, because Western Washington is not known for having very many caves at all. And we have bats here, but the question is, where do our bats go in the wintertime to hibernate?
A good example, a little brown bat tends to have an affinity for wintering in caves and mines out east, but our western subspecies out here, we don't know where it goes. We have some ideas based on some emerging science in the West that they may use places like talus slopes up in the mountains or turnip root wads and things like that in the forest. You're not getting thousands of bats in a root wad. And that might be, if that's the case here in Washington, that might be advantageous for our bats out here, because all the kindergartens are divided up much more finely rather than, these hundreds or thousands of individuals all in the same affected roost. So I have hope for that. But it's also very perplexing and kind of amazing that we have – I mean, these animals are very hard to study. And when I first started getting into bats and working with coworkers and other peers and elsewhere in academia or government, nonprofits, it was fascinating to me. Is wow, here we are, late 20th, early 21st century, and it's amazing how much we don't know about bats versus a lot of other taxa out there, and particularly mammals and other vertebrate species. It was surprising to me. So
I think that's partly because there's so many myths and fears about bats.
I think part of it has
been studied. Oh.
Yeah, I think maybe some of that is that, it takes, you have to be really interested in them because, there is a bit of, they do get lumped in with like the spiders and snakes. They're fascinating animals and they're each this little individual when you are actually, when researchers trap them, when you're holding them in hand, I mean, each one is an individual as opposed to, I've done a lot of trapping of birds too, and particularly like passers, little songbirds. They all kind of act the same. You have one robin acts the same as another robin. You get, a little brown or a big brown in your hand, and some of them, this guy is really mean, and he's trying to get through my glove and bite me, or this one's just kind of, I'm fine. And I don't want to anthropomorphize, but I am. Sometimes it seems like their facial expressions are different, too. So it's almost like I've had dogs and cats my entire life, and I've had, you know, with dogs and cats, they all are kind of individuals, and I've had dogs sort of make faces that are different than the other dog, or, you know, expressions. And I've noticed that in bats, too. And that was one thing that really hit me off the bat, pun intended, when I first started to get bat handling and knowledge under my belt, is that, man, these guys are just long-lived, really smart, and each individual is very much doing their own thing and have a high social factor, too.
That's very interesting, Chris, that bats have more of a personality like other mammals. I have noticed that in some wild mammals too, such as coyotes, that they each seem to have their own way of being and of reacting to human beings. But another thing you talked about is interesting to me too, and I think will be interesting to our readers, and that is, you mentioned that wildlife biologists such as yourself do capture bats in order to, you know, study them, and that involves, you know, holding them in their hand. And I wonder if you could tell us, what should a person do if they happen to find a bat that is injured or is just down on the ground for any reason?
You know, and that's something handling bat, please don't do. You know, any wildlife out there, and bats are, you know, they can in their populations. In the wild population, it's less than 1%, but bats can have rabies, and it's lethal. So, you know, and other wildlife can have pathogens that are zoonotic or transferable to humans as well. And so, you know, it's never a good idea to get close or handle wildlife without consulting with someone, like if it's an injured animal or something, calling a state wildlife rehabber. You know, that's the best thing to do. Leave it be until you get direction and guidance, or get someone that can come out and help you that's with those, you know, government or professional entities that have permits and work together on those situations. But, you know, when you're holding them in hand, I mean, each one is an individual. For example, our silver-haired bat is a solitary tree-dwelling and roosting bat, and the females, they'll go into cavities and crevices in trees, for example, and have one pup, you know, like a woodpecker hole each year. So, but a lot of the bats that we're dealing with, and that is a species that can carry the fungus, but isn't known to come down with it, the white nose syndrome, for example. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like our little brown or Yuma bat out here, which was the first new species out west documented here in Washington in 2017. They're very colonial and so have a high social need and drive in their life history. So, which is interesting. It's interesting that there's so much difference and fascinating animals.
I think they're actually just really beautiful to look at.
Yeah. I mean, I'm biased, but, you know, they're still fascinating. These are animals that are not only just of value of their own accord and for biodiversity, but provide a lot of ecosystem services for us and for our ecosystem in general. And it would be a huge loss. So,
So if a person that's living in Seattle, you know, was out at night in an area where there were bats, what would be the, like, typical bat species that they might see? You mentioned the silver-haired and the little brown and the Townsends. Are there any other species that might see?
Well, my experience, in Seattle, you know, some great places to watch bats in Seattle, for example, are, you know, right at Green Lake, right in the city there, out along anywhere along Lake Washington for, you know, these guys are they're variable because they, you know, insect-eating animals, and in this case bats that are, you know, our only true flying mammal, you know, insect hatches, they are site-specific and driven by the right conditions. So their presence for foraging, and particularly in Western Washington where we have more open water and wetland complexes than more dry Eastern Washington, they really can sometimes be there and sometimes not or in less numbers because of, for example, that insect hatches are just dynamic over space and time. And I've been at Magnuson, actually, for example, gearing up for, I think they still do, Seattle Parks supported kind of an urban camp out for children and their families there.
Mm-hmm.
We've done outreach during that, and we've been there night before, had tons of Yuma, little bat, little brown bats, flying over Lake Washington, feeding right there, using an acoustic monitor to identify them from the shoreline. And also, you know, seeing them in, before it got too dark, foraging. And then the next night or next two nights, we go there and nothing, you know, we don't have anything. And that's very likely due to that insect activity you know, and just having that en masse because we've had a huge hatch of something. And then there's still bats around. We're there the next few days, but we don't have that en masse observation that we've had.
Makes me realize how lucky we were also on that July 27th walk that there were so many different species.
So in Seattle, you know, I mean, we will have, you know, like little brown, big brown, Yuma myotis, California myotis. You will have western long-eared occasionally. Pretty much, I mean, all the bats we know on the west side we can have. The core urban ones that I've experienced and also in chatting with other folks that manage or are bat enthusiasts or researchers are kind of like your big brown, your little brown, Yuma, California, silver-haired. Those are solidly, I mean, you'll find those in Seattle. And you should have, if you're in the right place and they're long enough and you're taking the right measures to see what else is out there, you'll have, you know, two to three of those other species as well. But a good solid five of those in general. So in real urban areas. Now, we've done, you know, acoustic monitoring in areas right around Seattle, and we've had all the known species in Western Washington. So it's possible to have those, I would say, at any given time, even in suburban areas of Seattle, like Green Lake. Mm-hmm. Bats Northwest runs in the summer, bat outreach right at Green Lake. It's outlined on their website. And we partnered with them occasionally in outreach there as well, particularly when White Nose first started. And it's a great opportunity for folks that haven't or just want a guided version of how to see bats and learn about them. It's a great thing to go to. You know, go there in the evening. There's a real nice backlit area near the bathhouse. And the bats are regular. They always show up generally. And you always have, for sure, little brown, big brown, and silver haired. And then from there, it can vary given the stars aligned and the conditions and et cetera. So.
And they list those all on their website as the dates and times of their summer bat walks.
They do, yeah. And I look forward to Fish and Wildlife, you know, have a little more capacity to get back into partnering with folks like that. But luckily we have a network of multiple entities that are working hard to provide outreach and conservation efforts, funding, on-the-ground efforts, research for our bats, just because they're bats, but also because of white-nose syndrome. So it takes a village.
Yeah, absolutely. And we really appreciated the Bats Northwest consulting with us on the scout projects that we did at Magnuson in terms of where to site the bat boxes for the, you know, best chance of success. And really appreciated their willingness to work with us on that.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent. Well, thanks for everything, and I appreciate it. I look forward to opportunity in the future to work together. So.
Thanks. Me too.
Fantastic.
All right. Have a great afternoon.
Yeah, you too. Have a good one. Take care.
See you in the park.